In, let's just take the aesthetic domain for the moment. In the whole history of ceramics, the Chinese developed some of the most elegant work imaginable. You are probably aware, I don't see a specimen, of the great work of the Sung and Korean potters. Very often done in a jade-like green, the most gorgeous texture. It looked practically as if it was carved out of jade. Well, that led on, you see, to the high techniques of the Ming Dynasty with translucent porcelain, white clay, the most subtle designs of all. And that style went also to Japan. And the very, very rich people you read about in, say, books like The Tale of Genji, and you see in a film, and you must see it, Chushingura, the story of the 47 Ronin. The lovely things they had around their houses were unbelievable. The lacquer, the boxes in pure gold, and, you know, it was delicious stuff. But then, it was just like having too much eclairs and ice cream and filet mignon and cooked à la carême, you know, that French cook who made everything look like an oriental palace. And now what happened? The people who practiced Zen suddenly got an eye for the beauty of the ordinary. There were two reasons for this. One was that they became fascinated with what happened spontaneously, what pattern a brush would make when handled roughly and the hairlines were shown. They also, because they practiced Zazen, which is sitting quietly, not thinking of anything special, but having a completely open mind, that puts you into a state where you get much better eyes and ears than you ordinarily have. And you start really seeing things. So you know that famous haiku poem, "The old pond, a frog jumps in, plop." In Japanese, that plop is mizu no oto, sound of the water. And there's another poem just like it, "In the dark forest, a berry drops, the sound of the water." Somebody suddenly realized, you see, just the sound of the water is marvelous. That's all. They found that they kept getting in very, very cheap Korean rice bowls. The poorest, cheapest kind for peasants to eat out of. And suddenly it struck one of these Zen masters that that was an incomparably beautiful object. Nobody had seen this before. They also had the simplest wooden ladles, bamboo, and then a stick in it for use in the kitchen. And one day somebody noticed that this ordinary, everyday kitchen utensil was just lovely. And so in the same way, they found that it was quite as satisfactory to listen to the kettle boiling as to listen to an elaborate concert. So what did they do? They started, through particularly a man called Senno Rikyu, to give parties for very small few guests in shacks, little huts in the garden, made of very primitive materials, such as mud walls, and where they would go and sit, and out of the simplest utensils, carefully chosen by a superb artist, they would simply sit and enjoy the uncomplicated life. And so was born the tea ceremony. Now look at that, you see, in the historical context, that's terribly important. It was a going back to the primitive after people were sick of too much civilization. And yet, it was going on to the primitive rather than back. Because the people who selected all those things, they knew the whole tradition of their civilization, their culture. They weren't barbarians. This became the rage. Rikyu became attached to the court. The shogun had tea with Rikyu. And everybody started digging tea ceremony. And in due course, the whole thing became awful. Because what's happened today is this. Tea ceremony is essentially something to enjoy. And there are a few men left who know how to serve tea ceremony. And it's an extremely congenial, quiet get-together. With easy conversation, simple and unostentatious manners, and really lovely things to look at. I was present at a tea ceremony celebrated by a Zen monk who happens to be an American. And he is a man who has done a lot of mountaineering. And he has, therefore, with him at all times, the sort of equipment that you take on camping in the mountains, because he does a lot of climbing in Japan. And I said to him, won't you, this afternoon would be very nice to have the tea ceremony, and you did it once before here, and it was so pleasant. Would you serve it again? He said, yes, by all means. Before, he had served tea ceremony in the style that Zen monks do it, which is rather simple and direct and much more comfortable than all these well-educated ladies who are on tittering about it and are on tiptoe and nervous and hoping they won't make a mistake and all that kind of thing. It's just dreadful. So he suddenly came in with a small Primus stove, set that down. Then he had an old paint pot, which had inside it an aluminum mug. He set that down. He then proceeded to take the aluminum mug out, pour water into the paint pot, and set that on the Primus stove, but he ritually pumped up the Primus stove. He did everything in the style of tea ceremony, but this was a dirty old Primus stove. And suddenly the thing began to flame like the god Fudo, and he mixed the tea in the traditional way with the whisk, had all the perfect and lovely manners, handing us the aluminum cup. And we got into a long... It's the custom after the tea ceremony, after you've drunk, to pass all the utensils round for inspection. And this is exactly what happened. And we found that the aluminum cup had the year 1945 stamped on it for some reason. We got into a discussion about styles of aluminum cups made in 1945. And it was the funniest thing, but it was a complete makeover of the tea ceremony into the modern idiom. Of course, the tea drunk in tea ceremony is that powdered green tea, which you don't steep like you make ordinary tea. You whisk it, and mixed with a small amount of hot water, into a froth. And it's called liquid jade. And it's a bit of an acquired taste for most Westerners. It tastes a little bit like a mixture of mate tea and Guinness. But when you get to know it, it's very invigorating and very awakening. And if you make up a strong mixture of it, it's a good thing to use if you want to stay awake all night and do work. And so you see, the legend was that Zen monks started this interest in tea because they needed it to stay awake during their practice of meditation. And it said that Bodhidharma is always drawn with eyes that are wide open. Why? Because he hasn't got any eyelids. Once when he was meditating, he fell asleep. And he was furious and cut his eyelids off. And as they dropped on the ground, up came the first tea plants. That's why they have leaves shaped like eyelids. and are to be drunk ever thereafter for staying awake. So the plant of Buddhism, tea is the Buddhist drink, just like wine is the Christian drink, coffee is the Islamic drink, and milk the Hindu drink. Every religion has its drink. So then around this kind of appreciation, born of stillness and the delight in seeing how nature takes its course, came the entire cult of Zen art with its special kind of primitivity, its special ceramics, its special calligraphic styles, and its special gardens, which are the controlled accident. Now you see, this is a water jar. They like to leave the bottom unglazed. You can really see that it's clay that way. But look, you see how the glaze has been allowed to run. It's what we would call not neat at all. And you watch somebody make one of these. And I have watched a man just pick up the plate, and as he applies the design of the glaze, he just goes whoosh with a brush and lets it drop on, and it's done. There's another man who glazes by wood smoke, and in his kiln he may put about 1,100 pieces, and he wraps them in straw. And wherever the straw touches, it leaves a splash of orange color against a purple background. Now, you see, the straw arranges itself according to the nature of straw. It doesn't follow strict human direction. And the fascination is when they open up that kiln and bring the things out, they look eagerly to see, what has the straw done? So, this principle of letting glaze run to see what will happen is Wu Wei. This is non-interference. This is Mu Xin also. No purpose, or it can also be translated, no specific intent. And now, of course, you see, sometimes this doesn't work. And the master picks it up and says, that's not very interesting, and rejects it. What are the canons of taste which decide whether he will accept one of these accidents or reject it? Because here an additional principle of control enters. See, say in the practice of calligraphy, a man may sit down with a huge pile of paper in front of him and do piece after piece after piece, and if it isn't just right, he throws it away. So he eventually makes a selection that comes out. There's a famous story of a Zen master who was doing calligraphy, and he had a very smart monk standing beside him who was his assistant. And the monk said, to each one as he did it, you can do better than that. Oh, no, no, come now. You know much better than that. This master got more and more furious, but the monk had to go out to the benjo, to the toilet for the moment. And he thought, quick, while he's away, he did it. And the monk came back and looked at me and said, a masterpiece. So there's this element of selection, you see. Now, what determines this? How do you know? Or another example of this, there was a tea caddy, porcelain tea caddy, not porcelain, but clay. And when Senno Rikyu was having tea ceremony, he saw this tea caddy and made no comment on it. And the owner was so disappointed that he smashed it. But one of his friends picked the broken pieces out of the trash can and took them to a mender. And he said, look, mend this with gold. And he put, therefore, gold cement and put this caddy back together. And so it had all over its surface spidery lines of gold. And when Rikiu saw that, he was just enchanted. And it became one of the most valuable tea caddies in the Japanese collections. Spidery lines of gold following just the apparently chance marks of a smash. There was a competition at the Art Institute in the University of Chicago in which it was a sculpture class, and the competition was that each student was given a cubic foot of plaster of Paris. And they said, now do something with it. Well, the prize was won by a woman who looked at this cube and said, it has no character. It doesn't want to be anything. So she flung it on the floor and smashed it all up. I mean, she made dents in it and banged off the corners and put cracks in it and things. Then she looked at it again. She said, ah, now I know what it wants to be. And so she followed the grain in it, as it were, made by all these cracks, and produced this marvelous piece of sculpture. You have in this area a very ingenious sculptor by the name of Donald Hoard, who is a master at following the grain in wood and actually making the grain. The grain seems to suggest to him the muscles and the flow of the kind of body that he's making. Well, that's the thing. So when a master decides whether the accident came off, what he wants is this. He wants the thing to be the perfect harmony of man and nature, of order and randomness. Now, this is a curious thing in the human mind. When we play games, we get most fascination out of those games which satisfactorily combine skill and chance. Games like bridge, poker, have a sort of admirable combination of these two elements. And we can go on playing those games again and again and again, because you don't feel completely at the mercy of chance, as you do with dice, unless you cheat. And you don't feel completely at the mercy of skill as you do with chess, or especially with a game like three-dimensional chess. So there's a sort of optimum middle where order and randomness go together. Well, that's what this man is looking for. He's looking for the optimal combination. You see, the things that are artwork like Persian miniatures or the jewelry of Cellini, and Chinese porcelain, is too much skill, too much order. It's like those houses you go into where you daren't put an ash in the tray because everything is so clean and everything is so tidy, you daren't touch it. One prefers a house, you see, that looks a little lived in, that is more genial, more comfortable, somehow invites you to sit down and even put your feet on the table. Whereas on the other extreme, some kind of pad where everything is covered in dirt and filthy clothes are thrown in the corner and, you know, people are all paint all over them and so on. That's the other extreme. We don't want that. But that's that curious thing in the middle. Now, the most difficult thing is to hold to the middle. It's like walking a tightrope. And that's why the path of Buddhism is called the razor's edge. Because you see what happened. When all this kind of work in the course of history became fashionable, people began to affect these styles. For example, when Sesshu, the great master ink painter, worked, he would sometimes take a handful of straw and paint with that instead of a brush, in order to get the sort of rough effect that he wanted. But later on there came people who could take an ordinary paintbrush and so exactly ink that brush that it would give precisely the messy effect that they had in mind. They would also be able to ink a brush in such a way, and this is terribly decadent, They could dab grapes on a vine and have dark ink where the shadow was supposed to be, and no ink at all where the highlight was supposed to be. That's when they started getting mixed up with Western ideas about shadows and perspective. They didn't have that earlier. But they were so skilled in the handling of ink that they would do this sort of thing, and they would imitate, you see, all the so-called rough natural effects of the great Zen artists. And so today in Japan, a younger generation of artists has decided it's time to break all that up. If we imagine, for example, haiku parties, the writing of haiku poetry, Basho, who was the great 17th century master of haiku, said, get a 3-foot child to write haiku, because they are the sort of direct, guileless things that children would say. But now there are magazines devoted to haiku poetry, where in every issue there will be 10,000 haikus written by people all over the country. And they get so stilted and so affected that one wished one had never heard of haiku. The same thing is starting over here. And you should see the entries we get in these haiku competitions that Japan Airlines and other people sponsor. But it all, after a while, becomes dated, stilted, and so somewhere again, the new thing has to break out, which is always coming up. But there's no formula, you see, for fixing it so that you can do it again and again and again, because the moment you start doing it again and again and again, it isn't it anymore. The real thing has escaped. Do you remember? Some time ago, there was a fashion for having wrought iron fish, just the outline of a fish. Some artist originally, you know, put this fish together and it looked great. But then you suddenly found them in every gift shop and dime store, and they looked perfectly terrible. So this is the mysterious thing. Well, not only in the arts, but in lifestyles, in everything, when you start saying, what is the technique for getting this thing? And people say, well, this is it. It's gone. Same in education. Same in music. The moment you start teaching something, what question are you asking? How could we, is there some method whereby in our schools we could produce from the music department every graduation ceremony 3 musicians of the stature of Bach or Mozart? Now, if we knew how to do that, that knowledge would prevent us from being surprised by the work of these people, because we would know how it's done. And when you know how something is done, it doesn't surprise you. That's why there's a Zen poem which says, if you ask where the flowers come from, even the god of spring doesn't know. Certainly the god of spring would be supposed to know where the flowers come from, but the truth of the matter is he doesn't. And so in the same way, if you ask the Lord God, how do you create the universe? He said, I have no special method. And this is known in Zen as a very difficult, this is the most difficult virtue to attain. So many of these things begin with mu. Buji. Buji. It means nothing special. It means no business. No artificiality. In American current, real cool. So, buji is where something doesn't stand out like a sore thumb. But it is absolutely different from being modest. A buji person may be immodest, in the sense that if he knows he can do something well, he just says he can. He doesn't go at all sorts of blushing violet techniques. Buji, you see, is this mysterious quality of nothing special, no special method. Because if there is, let me repeat, if we do know the method and we know it infallibly, it ceases to be interesting. There are no surprises left. And the moment the element of surprise is gone, the zest of life is gone. That, you see, is why it's very difficult to teach Zen to yourself. Because you can't easily surprise yourself. The essence, you see, of this kind of spontaneity is response to a surprise. So the master, you don't know what he's going to do, and he surprises you. It's like trying to cure hiccups. Very difficult to cure yourself, because when you pat yourself on the back, you know when you're going to do it. So you're all ready for it. When somebody else comes up and slams you on the back, then that's a surprise, and what you needed was a surprise. Or it's like jokes. What makes you laugh about a joke is the element of surprise in it. That's why jokes aren't funny after they've been explained. So in the same way, all these Zen stories, if explained, have no effect. They're intended to produce what I would call metaphysical laughter. But this has to be a surprise. And so as to be surprised, well, there's no way of premeditating it. So you see, if you read, for example, there's a book out here called Zen by Eugen Herigl, who studied archery. Many of you have probably read this book. He had to learn to pull the bowstring in the manner of the Japanese archer and let it go, but not on purpose. He had to let it go without thinking first, I'll let it go. And then let go. He had to let it go, not on purpose. Now, that really bugged Herigl. How do you do something not on purpose? Especially if you're aiming at a target. Well, the whole point is, if you think before you shoot, it's too late. The target's moved. That's why we have a thing like beginner's luck. You see, if you simply point at something like that, if your finger was a gun, I would probably have hit the light switch. And so you get a person who's naive about a gun, will pick a gun up and bang, and the thing will drop dead. I'll never forget the first time I ever used a slingshot. This friend of mine was with me, and he was aiming away and not missing, and I just picked it up, and ping, and it hit. But I couldn't do it again. you get a certain naturalness there. So, there was a master by the name of Ikkyu, who was a great leg puller. And he had in front of his house a very gnarled pine tree. One of those things that's contorted, and they love this kind of thing. And he put a notice up by it. It said, I, Ikkyu, will pay 100 yen, which was a fair amount of money in those days, to anyone who can see this tree straight. Well, soon, there was a whole crowd of people around that tree, lying on the ground and twisting their necks and looking at it from all sorts of angles. And there was absolutely no way of seeing the tree with a straight trunk. But Ikkyu had a friend who was a priest of another sect. And a smart boy went over to see this friend and said, what about this Mr. Ikkyu's tree? Oh, said the other priest, it's perfectly simple. He said, you go and tell him the answer to seeing the tree straight is to look straight at it. So this man went over to Ikkyu and said, I claim the reward. He said, you look straight at it. And Ikkyu looked him in a funny way and said, he forked out the 100 yen and gave it to him. He said, I think you've been talking to Rosen down the street. Now, in that way, you see, just look straight at it. In other words, here's the bowstring, let go of it. Don't all this fimble-fambling, mimble-mambling, jumble-humble about the right technique of letting go of it. Let go of it, damn it. But that's very difficult. It's as if I would say to you, now everybody, let's be unselfconscious. And so finally, in desperation, you at last learn to let go of the thing, which was what you were supposed to do all the time. And then one is, as again, as a child. This is original innocence. So this is the meaning of the person who was asked, what do you do here in this Zen institution? He said, we eat when hungry and we sleep when tired. Well, he said, that's being just like everybody else. They all do that. He said, they do not. When they eat, they don't eat. But they think of all sorts of extraneous matters. When they're tired, they don't sleep. They dream all kinds of dreams.
Your It continues with Session 6. Uncarved block, unbleached silk.
Now, what I want to talk to you about this afternoon are some of the aesthetic principles underlying both Chinese and Japanese arts, deriving from these Taoistic and Buddhistic philosophies that have inspired them, and to speak about them fairly technically. In the language of Taoism, there are certain words used which are the foundations of their aesthetic ideas. One of these words is the uncarved block, and another is unbleached silk. The Taoists make a distinction between the natural and the artificial, and seem to be all on the side of the natural and rather against the artificial. Although you must be cautioned against taking this too seriously, too literally. You might say, of course, that the distinction between the artificial and the natural is an artificial distinction, because really and truly a human building is no more nor less artificial than a bird's nest. But the Taoists use a kind of art and a kind of poetry which you could call indicative. That is to say, while understanding that everything that man does is natural, some things that he does are more natural than others. That is to say, they look more natural. They go that way. And so the idea of unbleached silk means silk in the raw silk, natural silk. And so in the same way, the uncarved block is the sort of stone that would be selected for a Chinese or Japanese garden. Chinese stones tend, as I see it, to be rather more elaborate, rather more fussy than Japanese stones. And I think that in the art of bonseki, which means growing rocks, the Japanese are a bit more sophisticated than the Chinese, although this doesn't often happen. But the Japanese are masters at growing rocks. So this rock that you would find in a Japanese garden is the uncarved block. Even though it may have been... what has happened, really? It's what we call in the West an objet trouvé, where the artist, instead of making something, selects it. He finds a glorious thing and shares his finding with other people, and that finding is a work of art. And you see, that is connected with the whole thought in this tradition of aesthetics in the Far East, that superb art is a work of nature. It is not something imposed upon nature, even though, as you've seen in many Japanese gardens, that there is very complex espalier work on trees, and that an enormous amount of pruning and trimming is done. And in fact, the discipline of the garden is amazingly complicated requires a great deal of care. But the object always is through the discipline of the art, to make the garden seem more natural than it would look if you left it to itself. You understand that? Is to work upon nature with skill and craft, but to move in the direction in which nature is already going. So that the uncarved block may be extended into a sculpture. But what the carver, to make the block uncarved even when the sculpture is finished, what the sculptor is going to ask the block in the first place is, what do you want to become? In other words, along what lines have you already started in the direction of a sculpture? And I will cooperate with you and bring it to completion. So that's the principle, really, you see, that underlies judo. Judo means the gentle way, the gentle Tao. And it is the art of going along with nature. It is also called Wu Wei or Mui in Japanese. And not doing nothing, literally, not being, because after all it's man's nature to act. You can't do nothing, literally. But to act Mui without, really, it is to act without feeling that your actions are separate from nature. When you feel that everything you do is simply part of the course of things, then the way in which you do things is changed. You wouldn't think so. It isn't logical that it should be. But nevertheless, if you really feel that you can't deviate from the Tao, and that it lies behind everything that you do, your type of action and your style of behavior will in fact be changed. And it will tend to be in the direction of your seeming to other people in some ways to be more passive than you might ordinarily be. And the difficulty here is that Westerners, when they hear about Buddhism and Taoism and this sort of thing, they interpret it one-sidedly as passivity and don't see that what sometimes looks like passivity is cleverness. You, as businessmen often know, if you leave letters unanswered for a month, when you return to them, many of them have already answered themselves. And sometimes when you sit and do nothing, you avoid making very serious mistakes, which would have arisen if you had acted prematurely, if you had done something about it. I've practiced inactivity of this kind for many years and have always been accused of being lucky, because when I should have done something and been up and at it, I just went and sat and did nothing. And then when it turned out all right, this is terrible. Oh, just lucky. No, I know, you haven't said that. That's why I'm still married to you. Yeah, it's all right. And, but anyway, this is so, isn't it? So, this tendency to look inactive and to go in the direction in the arts of a kind of primitivity, which we know in the word shibui, the quality called shibui in Japan, is a certain kind of sophisticated primitivity. Listen to these contradictions, these paradoxes. The sophisticated primitivity, controlled accident, where you see man and nature are really collaborating, man as the controller, the reasoner, the logical being, and yet at the same time not ruining life by making it all logic and all control. To have logic and to have control, that is to say, in short, to have order, you have to have randomness. Because where there is no randomness, order cannot manifest itself. Well, now, in the vocabulary of Japanese aesthetics, there are a number of terms which
are basic. The first is sabi. And that goes along with something that rhymes with it, wabi. So often Japanese speak of wabi-sabi or sabi-wabi as a kind of mood of a certain art feeling or of zen taste. And then there is aware, which I've mentioned in passing, as another kind of mood. There is yugen. There is furyu. Such words which designate the basic moods of painting and poetry and so on. Now, to begin with sabi, the basic feeling of sabi is loneliness. One of the great paintings that illustrates sabi is the lonely crow on a tree branch. It is the feeling of the hermit. It is the feeling which the garden artist tries to create when in a crowded country he wants to give you the sensation of being way off in a mountain landscape. So this sense, you see, of solitariness, of being able to wander off on your own, is sabi, and is a thing, of course, that any sane person has to have. One has to have privacy. You have to have space in which to be alone, so as not to become a rubber stamp. You see, it's often thought that Eastern philosophy is against individuality. And this is not true. The unity of man and the universe is not a loss or a merging of personality in something impersonal. It's more like the fact that when individuality, when personality is known and experienced as an expression of the whole cosmos, then the person becomes more individual, not less individual. But he becomes individual in a non-strident way, in a way that has in it the spirit of the uncarved block and the unbleached silk. And so one of the qualities of this is solitariness. The great Chinese poem, which has sabi in it preeminently, is asking for the master. I ask the boy beneath the pines. He says the master's gone alone, herb gathering, somewhere on the mount, cloud hidden, whereabouts unknown. So all the whole idea, you see, of Zen, that wherever you stand, if you realize Zen, you create a mountain. Everywhere is the mountain solitude, even in the middle of an uproar. This is sabi. Now there is next wabi. This is a more difficult idea. Let's imagine that you are feeling very bad about something. You're depressed. The world is too much with you. Just, you're sick of life. And then, quite surprisingly, you notice a small weed growing underneath a hedge. And this weed is really, after all, not just to be dismissed as a weed, but some rather lovely design there is in the nature of this plant. Or supposing you are bothered by financial uproar, wars, politics, and everything like that, and you are sitting on a beach, and you become aware of the water endlessly crossing pebbles. And you get a sense that this goes on forever and ever and ever. It is long before you were thought of, long before all human history, empires, schemes, and so on, and will endure long after. But it's something that strikes you that is very simple, very ordinary, like the water on the pebbles, or like the little weed under the hedge, that suggests a kind of amazing eternal reliability of nature. that in the very humble form goes on and on and on, and whatever human beings may do, this everlasting sanity persists. Now, that strange flip from the mood of depression to the mood of a certain consolation in this weed is wabi. Now, don't let me be too dictatorial. I'm trying to explain these things through examples rather than through trying to give you philosophical definitions. It's better to give examples than to pin it down with abstract terminologies. Wabi comes out in the haiku very much. A brushwood gate, and for a lock, this snail. This is wabi. This is all there is. The path comes to an end among the parsley. Which has a touch of Yugen, but also wabi, because the parsley is just... Well, everybody has parsley in the garden. Next, this word aware, A-W-A-R-E, is very much connected with the Buddhist feeling for the transience of life. That everything is change, and nothing at all can be held on to or possessed. This feeling of transience is at the root of the philosophy of poverty that exists in Buddhism, and it has a curious difference in it from the Christian philosophy of poverty, as, say, explained by St. Francis of Assisi. It's cognate to it, it's like it, but a little subtle difference. Somehow one feels in the Christian emphasis on poverty that poverty contrasts with richness as good to evil. In other words, poverty is unpleasant, but it's something you ought to share with the poor who live unpleasant lives. So if you are to expiate your sins, well, you ought to be poor and to live roughly. And so, if for this reason, in Buddhism, one would not say so much poverty as one would say simplicity. Not going without, not clinging to things because it's good for you, but because it is actually the happiest way to live. Because nothing is more terrifying than the state of chronic anxiety which one has if you are subject to the illusion that something or other in life could be held onto and safeguarded. And nothing can. So the acceptance of everything flowing away is absolutely basic to freedom, to being unsui, a cloud water person who drifts like cloud and flows like water. But in this, we mustn't take ourselves too ridiculously. I mean, naturally, all human beings have in them a certain clinging. See, you can't let go totally. You wouldn't be human if you did. You can't be just a leaf on the wind, or just a ball in a mountain stream, to use a Zen poetic phrase. Because if you were that, you wouldn't be human. Just as I pointed out that a person with no emotions, who has completely controlled his emotions, is a stone Buddha. So a person who would be completely let go would also be some kind of an inanimate object. So Zen very definitely emphasizes being human, being perfectly human as its ideal. And so to be perfectly human, one must have not a state of absolute detachment, but a state of detachment which contains a little bit of resistance. A certain clinging still. They say in India of a Jivan Mukta, a man who is liberated in this world, that he has to cultivate a few mild bad habits in order to stay in the body. Because if he were absolutely perfect, he would disappear from manifestation. And so the yogi, great yogi, maybe he smokes a cigarette or has a bad temper occasionally, something that keeps him human. And that thing, little thing, is very important. It's like the salt in a stew. It grounds him. Well, this is another way of saying that even a very great sage, a great Buddha, will have in him a touch of regret that life is fleeting. Because if he doesn't have that touch of regret, he's not human, and he is incapable of compassion towards people who regret very much that life is fleeting. So the mood aware is that touch of regret, of nostalgia, of, you know that poem which speaks of the feeling of a banquet hall deserted. Here it is, there's been a great banquet, you know, and it's all the guests have gone home, and there are empty glasses and dirty plates and crushed napkins and all sorts of things all over, and somehow the echo of voices and merriment is still there. And so this mood, aware, comes up. So even a very great person should feel that, because the price otherwise is not to be human. So for this reason, Buddhist and Taoist poetry is not unemotional. It's not dehumanized, and so somehow speaks very much to us as people, and does not have in it the feeling that we ought instead to turn into saints or supermen. That's the humane thing about this philosophy of life. The next word, the special term, is furyu. Furyu means literally wind flow. Fu is the character for wind. Ryu means flowing. And the dictionaries translated elegance, and this won't do. Furyu, first of all, you must remember that the word wind is used in Chinese and Japanese alike to indicate atmosphere. The atmosphere of a place. So when a person has, say, a certain school of poetry or philosophy, it's called the family wind. That means the atmosphere, the slant, the attitude of this particular school. So that meaning of wind, atmosphere, comes into the expression furyu. And furyu is like this. Here is a man fishing, and he's sitting in the evening, in the twilight, on the edge of a river with his fishing rod in a lonely little boat tied up by the bank. Now, if this man is fishing with his mind intent simply on catching fish, this is not furyu. But if he's also digging the atmosphere, it's furyu. To flow with the wind, you see, to dig the atmosphere. American offers the most beautiful possibilities of translation in our incomparable slang for some Oriental ideas. Furyu is to get with it, to flow with it. And not again, you see, in the sense of the merely passive leaf flowing on the wind. But furyu has in it, you see, a touch of self-consciousness, like that man fishing. Now, you would think, if you studied Taoist philosophy, that this would be very bad. Zhuangzi somewhere says that a comfortable belt is one that you don't feel, and you're unaware of it. That's not the most comfortable belt. Like comfortable shoes, would you be completely unconscious of comfortable shoes? No. Something better than comfortable shoes are shoes that you know are comfortable. So, in the same way, self-consciousness adds something to life. It's one thing to be happy and not know it. It's another thing to be happy and to know it. It's like one's voice in a shower room or bathtub has more resonance. And that's why temples and cathedrals and resonating boxes for guitars and drums and things are created, to give this little quality of echo. For all echo is a certain kind of feedback which enables you to reflect upon what you are doing and to know that you know. So one might say that ordinary people are Buddhas, but they don't know it. And a Buddha is one who knows he's a Buddha. Only, they don't let you settle for this comfortably and easily, because really to know is also defined as not to know. In the Upanishads, it is said that if you think that you know what Brahman is, you have yet some study to be done. For those who know Brahman do not know Brahman, and those who do not know Brahman really know. Now, all this paradoxical language is intended to keep you confused, so that you can't say, I've got it. So, but this position, you see, is not one-sided. There is something about being human, about being self-conscious, that is not a mistake of nature, not a completely evil fall into self-awareness. But self-awareness, although it creates all kinds of problems, because through self-awareness, the human being is in some sense a self-frustrating mechanism. He knows that he's going to die. And the price of being able to control the future is to know that in the long run you won't be able to, and worry about that. But also, with self-consciousness goes the possibility of resonance, of realization, of becoming enlightened, liberated, and knowing it, and therefore able to enjoy it. So, Furyu adds to the dimension of going with it something more than the mere passivity of going with, but knowing that you're going. But it does at the same time, that it isn't entirely wrong that the dictionaries have translated it elegance. You could say Furyu is style. When we say somebody really has style. Now, but this designates a particular kind of style. It is the style of what one might call the elegant poor man, the aristocratic bum, the rich pauper, you see. Now, you find that a good deal in the things that we've been seeing. We've gone to many temples where nobody really owns anything, and yet, in a way, they're luxurious. This is for you. The next word is Yugen. I have spoken about Yugen, but I haven't told you. The basic symbol of Yugen is the flower which grows from a rock. And so there is something about that which is improbable, mysterious, contradictory, that a flower could come out of a rock. Yugen, more than any other of these terms, defies translation. The two characters, which I shall draw for you shortly, are rather interesting. One, the first character, Yu, shows the basic form of a mountain. And then the mountain is combined with characters indicating darkness. You see, in the character for mountain, which is simply like this. There are these things here that are the valleys, and the dark is put in the valley, you see, in each case. Now, you get the idea of the deep valley. There's a poem which says, "The wind drops, but the petals keep falling. The bird calls, and the mountain becomes more mysterious." Little sounds emphasizing silence. Little motions emphasizing stillness. This quality, you see, is in this word yu. Gen is in Chinese xuan, which means the original deep, deep, mysterious darkness out of which everything arises. The depth. "And darkness covered the face of the deep, or the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters." Those waters of chaos, the primeval blackness, which is the same blackness as your head. You know how your head appears invisible to your eyes. That is Gen. It is darker than darkness, blacker than black. It is practically nothingness. It's so mysterious. So when you put these two characters together, you get Yugen. And so Yugen is, first of all, suggestiveness. I was looking round one of the temples a few days ago, where I noticed that you couldn't figure out how big it was. Or it didn't seem to have any limits. Because always every wall, say of a room, seemed to be a screen which led to something else beyond. And at the back of every garden there seemed to be a little gate that led to some other courtyard. And everything led into something else. And I said to the priest, "I don't know whether I'm going to go exploring or not, or just leave it alone. And think that, well, here I left Kyoto and I never did find out what was through that little gate. And so what? Or forever there will be magic behind there, which I didn't define, I didn't draw in." And so this whole temple was done that way. All sorts of suggestions of little avenues disappearing, like a mountain path winding up among the trees. Where does it go? True, if you follow it. You'll eventually go up out of Kyoto here and get down to Otsu. And who knows, you'll find yourself back in the suburbs. But there is the sense of that disappearing mountain path, like we've got going up here, that it goes to the place. And everybody has in their back of their minds an image of the place that you want to go to. Or some, not really an image though, it's always slightly indefinite. There's the certain feeling of there ought to be somewhere the thing I've always wanted. We get disappointed, of course, because as we get older we feel that perhaps that doesn't exist at all. That one just has to put up with the second best, or with something. Half a loaf is better than no bread. But still, I find that Far Eastern art is very, very full of hints about what is sometimes called Horaisan. Horaisan is the magical island somewhere out in the Pacific, which is the Paradise Island. And all these Chinese paintings of wonderful floating pagodas and terraces with scholars sitting around drinking wine and so on are hints of the paradise world. And that somewhere then these little steps lead up to that thing. And you've seen these steps. Japan is full of them. As you just go along in the train, you look up the hills, and there are arches, torii, steps disappearing into the hills, all of which suggest the feeling, somewhere up there is that thing. So Yugen, as it were, comes round full circle to Sabi. The wonderful lonely place at the end of the road, where there won't be any mother-in-law to bother you, any that sort of dreadful social difficulty, but the solitude which befits a bearded old gentleman. Now, of course, you see, all these things are symbols. On one level, they're very human, and they reflect our perhaps childish and immature desires to be really alone, to have that paradise thing. And realistic people say, well, you ought not to bother yourself or fool yourself with such fantasies. And nowadays I find that we feel very guilty about thinking of paradise, of horizon, or whatever it is, the enchanted garden. We think, nuh-uh. Reality is what you read about in the newspapers, and you've got to face it. And everything is unpleasant, basically. I know there's the hard-boiled school of zoologists, for example, who insist that birds hate flying. You know, everybody has always envied a bird and wanted to be able to glide along with wings, you know. And so there comes up somebody, who's usually some wretched academician, who says, no, we've discovered by measurements that birds loathe flying. You must feel very satisfactory when you found that out, because you've smashed an ideal. Oh, for the wings of a dove. Far away would I roam. In the wilderness, build me a nest, and remain there forever at rest. I'm quoting the Psalms. But apparently doves just hate this chore of flying. Now, it is just in the same way as it's ridiculous to try to be so inhuman as never to feel any regrets about the passing of time and of life, and so on. It's likewise inhuman not to have the paradise fantasy of the mysterious place round the corner, just over the crest of the hill, just behind the island in the distance. You see? Because that place is really the big joke. That's you. That's why you have found that at the end of the line, when you get through the last torii and up the last stairway, you are liable to be confronted with a mirror. And so everybody is seeking for that thing that you've got to have, you see. Well, you got it. But nobody's going to believe this. But there it is, the real thing that you are is the paradise land that you're looking for at the end of the line. And it's far, far more reliable than any kind of an external scene which you could love and cling to and hold on to. But of course, the whole fascination of life is that seems perfectly incredible.